there seems to be a lot of concern related to the dignified disposition of human Native American remains in this continent. I wanted to mention that this is reflected on a national scale as well. And within the last few weeks, Senator Melcher has sponsored legislation in the Senate to introduce some rules and regulations and some guidelines about the proper disposition of these remains, in addition to sacred ceremonial objects currently held in museums and other places. So I frankly don't know the content of the legislation. I just saw the fact that it was mentioned in a newsletter. But it seems to me as taxpayers, you have the option to contact your local representatives to determine what sort of things are contained in this legislation to see if it suits your concerns or it meets your concerns about these things, to see what you can do to get it through Congress and get it signed. It's a national problem. Perhaps the states may follow in turn.
We're going to move on now and have Chief Morgan Brandy introduce the next speaker.
Just prior to the introduction of the next speaker, I would like to mention one of the situations that I have witnessed. For an example, on the south side of Richmond, I work for the AT&T Installation Division, and they had sold some equipment to another communication concern. And upon arriving on that particular site on the south side, then I was told by some of the other contractors who were from out of state that this building was placed on top of an Indian burial ground. And the neighbors that lived in that area had quickly, upon finding the evidence there, had quickly scavenged everything that they could possibly find. And I understand that there was even some bones involved there. However, the reason that I was given for all of this taking place without there being any notification was it due to business deadline. And the loss of revenue if they didn't meet a particular date. So I think that there are many of the burial grounds that are just being bulldozed over. I think it's unfortunate, and it's rare that even we hear about it. They said that due to their business deadlines, then this was the reason that there was no interest taken, that they have, in fact, a chain of these offices that would take place along the railroad right away. With no more to say on that subject, I'd like to introduce to you Dr. James Axtell. I'll give you some of his background, which seems to be quite extensive. James Axtell was educated at Yale, Oxford, and Cambridge University, where he received his PhD before coming to the College of William and Mary in 1978. He taught at Yale, Sarah Lawrence College, and Northwestern. He is now William R. Keenan, Jr. Professor of Humanities, and teaches courses on the history of Indian-white relations in North America. The author or editor of 11 books and 35 articles. He's best known for the European and the Indian Oxford University Press, 1981, The Indian People of Eastern America and the Invasion Within, The Contact of Cultures in Colonial North America, which has recently won 3 major book prizes. His booklet on the rise and fall of the Powhatan Empire will be published next year by Colonial Williamsburg. Wish I could have said all of this without reading, but it was a little too much to remember. Dr. Axtell.
a snap job compared to Randy. He had 12,000 years. I only have 100 years. But unfortunately, I think you'll find that he could probably busy 100 years. And I'm actually only going to talk about the first 40 years of the 17th century through the use of slides. So if I have the light and the snap on projector. Can we take those down a little? The first thing you have to remember about colonial Virginia, from the Virginians, from the imported Virginians' viewpoint, is that the geography is very difficult. The way the rivers slice into the land makes communication north and south, this is, remember looking at it from England, very difficult. And the Indians, therefore, who live on the heads of those rivers or in the middle of them, really have the advantage against anybody who is going to try to control the whole area. Now, Randy has shown you some of these pictures, but I want to just comment on a couple of other things as we go along. The palisade, some villages are palisaded, but many of them are not. Those that might be on the coast might be, because coastal areas are accessible to canoe raids from other enemies. And the Powhatans who lived far up the rivers on the border of the Monacan, who are Siouan speakers, beyond the fall line, say Richmond, to draw a line in the west, then there are enemies over there. So those villages might be palisaded. But many Indian villages in the whole eastern woodlands are not, even as late as the 17th century. And the reason for that, given by the Indians, is very simple. They thought English forts were suicidal. You've essentially encaged yourself, and you can't get out if you're attacked. Indians thought it was much smarter to have an open village system, and if you're attacked by overwhelming numbers, then you can just go hide. You can hide in the cornfield and dive in the lake, and you can go anywhere you want to. The other interesting thing about this pictures, you've got cornfields in three different states of growth. The growing season down here was amazing to the English. I mean, you could literally plant in March, April, and May, and harvest three times in the fall, and that would just give you so much greater output. And the Europeans are always amazed by the productivity of Indian cornfields. If it weren't for those, of course, the whole Jamestown colony would have faltered very quickly. This is the inside of a longhouse. It's near a point of a Huron longhouse. Is that focused? My eyes are full. The bunk rows are along the middle. Archaeologically, of course, you can pick up all these support posts, and bunks are built against the sides of the houses. There will be a fire. There are a row of fireplaces down the middle. And two families will share a fireplace, one family on each side. So approximately, if you archaeologically, you dig up a site, you count fire pits, and then you multiply by about 8, because there are approximately 4 people in each family, 2 of them on each side, to get your overall population. They hang everything in the tops of the longhouses for essentially refrigeration. And it's all dried, it's all smoked. And these are very smoky facilities in the first place. Partly why the roofs are 20 feet tall. If they were any lower, you'd really have an awful lot of smoke and conjunctivitis. And the Indians did suffer from that in the 17th century, as did the Europeans who moved in with them. Now, the other kind of structure you'll find is the smaller domed wigwam that Randy pointed out. This is the one at Plymouth Plantation. These are how they're made. It's essentially the same principle as the longhouse. You just bend over the saplings and then layer reed mats up the sides. And then you can line the inside of the longhouse as well with finely woven matting. The other structure you might find in an Indian village or just outside it, depending on the group, is a menstrual hut, or several menstrual huts. This is a woman in a menstrual hut. The Indians believe that menstruation was associated with blood and life and death, and therefore the spiritual power of a menstruating woman was exacerbated. It was much greater than it was normally. And she had the power to, like all spiritual power in Indian societies, it's double-edged. It can be used for good and it can be used for evil. So, normally, she's isolated because most of this new power is on the evil side. It can cause a hunter to miss game. It can frighten game away. It can make a man sick. So that if you're in a hunting society, and the man is fairly important for providing, then you can't have him messed up, his sight or his aim or his health. And so you have to isolate this woman, essentially for her own good, for the good of the tribe. On the other hand, she has the ability to cure arrow wounds and to keep corn borers out of the corn, for instance. She drags her cloak around the cornfield late at night. That is like a guardrail shield that would keep the vermin away from the corn. Now, I want to talk just briefly about the difference between male and female roles. That may be more controversial than burials. Sometimes we get then. This is an upper-class Algonquian woman. We know this because she has a special haircut, signifying that she is married. But she doesn't have a broken arm. She has her arm in a wampum belt, essentially, a necklace. The purple and white form of status and money in these societies. And that's to signify that she doesn't have to work with her hands. She's upper class enough to have servants, possibly slaves, captives perhaps. And her daughter is imitating her by having her own little wampum belt and suggesting the same thing. Of course, children in the summer months went naked until they were 10 or 11. And so she's just wearing a small pad of moss, essentially a g-string. Mom just has an apron, essentially, a short mini skirt, and tattoos. Now, this is something I wish I knew more about, and I don't think I'm going to get any help from modern Indians, because we didn't get any help from the observers in the 17th century. This is the way Algonquian women, at least in Virginia, carried their babies initially. Now, obviously, they probably also use cradle boards for longer distance kinds of things. But this is one way they did that. Now, we know this is a very old Indian way of doing things in the eastern woodlands because we have pottery from the mound builders in the Ohio Valley around 500 A.D. that we have a pot that shows a mom carrying her baby just that way. But it must die out extremely fast, and I can't see any European objections to it. Nobody ever mentioned it. Nobody thought it was unusual. All they did was paint this one picture of it, and they made no comment. The only thing I can think of is that it might be used for male babies only, because male babies are supposed to have their sinews stretched at all times. In other words, you would alternate legs. You never impose heavy loads on Indian boys so that they can be fast runners, full of endurance, but they're not heavy porters or carriers of things. I have no idea. If anybody has any great ideas about why they did this, I'd like to know. Indian women, of course, are associated with the agriculture. The farmers in these societies are the women, not the men. The men might help clear the initial ground, get rid of the trees and large rocks and stumps, but then the women would take over and do most of the rest. This is a composite picture. I just used the top part to show you the agriculture. It's done not with draft animals. You don't have tame moose or something pulling the plow. It's hand agriculture, but you use hilling techniques. Instead of plowing up the whole darn field, you just hill up the earth every 5 or 6 feet, and then you plant corn, 5 or 6 corn seeds with bean seeds in the same pool. Why is that? Well, takes the nutrients out of the soil. But beans are nitrogen fixing, and they put it back in the soil. So it's a beautiful balance. And dietarily, the carbohydrates from corn and the protein from beans are a perfect complement. So it's almost succotash, in other words, is almost a complete meal as far as your body's concerned. And then in between, you would plant viney, pumpkin, squash, and things like that to reduce the need for weeding. You know, you just wouldn't waste the time weeding. And then they'd have, the whole field would be just filled with all kinds of vegetables and extremely productive. And they didn't use fertilizer. They did not use fish fertilizer in the eastern woodlands, as far as we know, not even in Plymouth. It's one of those suggestions. This is what a hill of corn looks like. Out here at Carter's Grove, they're trying to have a show agriculture in Virginia over 300 years, and they're starting with the Indian hilling techniques, which, by the way, the colonists adopted wholesale from the Indians. When the Europeans came, for 200 years thereafter, George Washington did this as well as anybody else. Europeans, while they didn't necessarily use hoes to do it, they used plows, but they cross-hatched their field several yards apart. Instead of plowing up the whole thing, they cross-hatched it so that at the point where the two rows met, you would have essentially a hill. And they planted their corn and beans exactly like the Indians did for 200 years. And corn is the staple crop in the American colonies throughout the whole colonial period. Now, the Indian women continue to process this corn, grinding it up in mortars, because Indian corn is very hard, even now, and then grinding it in stone pestles, and matate, essentially, to make bread. This is not a dead baby on a gravestone. This is supposed to be a cradle board, but the European artist didn't really know what it looked like. Now, the men get most of the publicity, as you can imagine, because of the male European observers who are writing all this stuff in. The man is dressed in just a breech clout, tattoos again like the wife. You can't see it too well, but the hair is all shaved off on the right side of his head. Why is that? Well, because when you pull a bow back, you pull it to your right ear, and if you've got a lot of long hair in it, you're likely to scalp yourself. That's a panther tail tied to the quiver. The Indian man, of course, is responsible for most of the activities outside the village. These are matrilineal societies, which mean the women, his hereditary succession goes through the women, and the women tend to own and control the villages, the houses in the villages, the village proper, and certainly the agricultural fields. The men are responsible for things outside the village, hunting, trade, diplomacy, and warfare. This is one technique of hunting, using decoys, sneaking up. But more likely, if you have fairly large populations, which you do now because of agriculture, you have to harvest game in large numbers. So you get Colonial Williamsburg to build you a beautiful picket fence, and you drive all the game into that so that you can kill large numbers. Obviously, this is supposed to be brush fence. This is a European artist's idea of what the description was supposed to be. All the women, children, everybody will make noise with deer horns and hoofs and things and drive game into an enclosure. But they also use sapling bent over with snares on the end of them, and they upend deer and fox and wolves, I suppose that is. Governor Bradford of Plymouth Plantation got caught in one of those ones. He thought it was very ingenious. Cut it down, took it home as a souvenir. The men are also responsible for most of the fishing, which is done in these dugout log canoes for the most part, or individually wandering around the water. But again, the tribe is going to get together and it's going to make a corporate activity of food production. And they're going to all build a weir across the river and catch large numbers of fish. This is not every man for himself kind of society. It's also a very socialistic society. I mean, it's communistic, really. communal. No one goes hungry. And the dugout canoe, before European tools are brought, iron steel tools, have to be done. You have to burn down the tree. You have to burn off the large branches. And you have to essentially burn out the inside. You just don't have the tools. You do have shell scrapers and stone scrapers, but you couldn't actually dig raw wood. So you have to use wet mud around the area you want to burn and keep moving and then scrape out the charcoal. And as the people at Jamestown can tell you, it's damn hard to get a fire to burn at a diagonal to cut off the end of the canoe perfectly. And then you dry the fish and then you hang it up in the top of your longhouse for a long time and keep it there preserved. Now this is, the men are also responsible for peace as well as war, and this is an older man who would have been a counselor. The councils tended to be male, although in Powhatan's empire we know about two so-called queens, female chiefs. But the village and tribal councils tend to be male. But women almost always have representatives in the form of male speakers who speak just for them. And women constitute a lobby group, a very strong lobby group. And if they don't want something done, their speakers are made very clear. They might use wampum belts in some tribes. I don't think we know about the Indians using them for these kinds of purposes. But they're also, the male role is warfare. When peace breaks down, peace is the normal state of affairs, as in most societies. And it's so easy from the textbook to get the idea of Indians do nothing but make war. So a lot of the pictures and descriptions we have are of Indian warfare. And it's important because they're trying to defend their own territory, of course, from these invaders. Warfare before European weapons comes is a lot different from the way it is after European weapons. Before, you might have large-scale mass attacks upon groups. But they stand at a respectable distance from each other for the most part and sort of loft arrows up in the air, several 100 yards away, hoping that one of them would hit somebody. Very seldom would they rush in suicidally and, point blank, try to stab somebody. The whole object is to get revenge for some previous wrong or to take a few captives. So you don't need to, you're not trying to annihilate the whole group. It's not genocidal. So you might have a mass attack. You might besiege a fort, a palisaded village. These are not little outhouses. They're supposed to be longhouses. And then the other form of combat is hand-to-hand, but that's rare. So when you're lofting arrows up in the air at each other, you can wear armor. And the Indians had a kind of slat armor made with birch bark or woven reeds or sticks, and they also use shields effectively. But as soon as European weapons come, this is a picture of Samuel Champlain against the Iroquois with his Huron and Montagnais allies and his other two henchmen in the woods. The Indians came out not knowing he had guns or what they were like in 1609, and they had this mass attack at each other. See how the arrows are just going up in the air at a distance? Well, he fires and kills three chiefs at once with one of his damn new weapons, and warfare has changed totally. And the Indians then revert to the other kind of warfare they have always practiced, which is rural warfare. Sneak up in small numbers on people and take a scalp and go home and or a prisoner and go home and be satisfied. Now, scalping is somewhat controversial, like burials, but there is absolutely no doubt that the Indians practiced scalping long before the white men got here. And we know that archaeologically, we know that documentarily, we know that pictorially, and we know that orally. It's not even a big deal, because you can survive scalping. all it is taking a piece of hair with a little skin attached off the crown of your head, where there was a special scalp lock worn for that purpose. And the scalp lock represents the person's soul, his personhood. And it sticks up, and it's braided, and it's painted, and it's decorated with lump and feathers and so on, as a taunt to your enemy to come and get it. And if he can come and get it, then he deserves to take over your personhood. You can survive scalping. There are lots of survivors in the records. But you become a non-person. You are no longer a member of a social group once you lose your scalp lock. And so you start to wander in no man's land between groups. The technique is very simple. The person is usually knocked out and down, face down on the ground. You put foot on the back, pull the hair back as tight as possible, holding down the scalp lock. You take a quick incision and you've got to use the hair with some skin. It's not a big deal. It's smart, but it doesn't kill you. But most warfare is aimed at taking captives. If you lose members in other wars with people, or after the Europeans come, you lose them because of epidemic diseases, then it's just very smart to take captives rather than to bring somebody back to torture and kill them, or just to bring back the scalp, which doesn't really have a lot of good. So the Indians would tend to bring back prisoners. And you see the scalp locks, which are there purposely. And here are two scalps that have been dried, put on a hook, dried over a fire, painted, and brought home sort of like a beaver skin. At night, you tie them down in this fashion, rope around the neck, under the sleepers. And here's a man drying the scalp over a fire. He's preparing, he's scraping the excess matter off, and he's going to put it on a hoop. And then they come into the village, and they have to run the gauntlet, which is not aimed at killing them or maiming them. On the contrary, it's just a symbolic kind of act of wiping the enemy blood out of them, of washing them clean, and then adopting them and giving them a new identity. Now, occasionally you'll bring back a prisoner because the grief of the village is recent and it's heavy, and you need to take revenge on a prisoner by torturing them. And so you put them on a scaffold. It's interesting. In fact, if you look at, if we had a better picture, there's another picture that shows Indians or prisoners are tied around a pole in front. You know, in the Western movies, they're always tied like this in the back to the pole. Indians always put you in the front, or stretched out on a scaffold. But, as I said, most prisoners are adopted by the tribes to replace fallen members. They are adopted exactly in the position and status and love that the person who has died held. So, and this includes Europeans, not only Indians. The Indians were adopting prisoners long before the whites got here. But when the Europeans come and get involved in wars, they continue to adopt white people and black people. This is a picture as late as 1764 of a military treaty that's been imposed because the English marched into the Ohio country and demanded that some prisoners, that all the white prisoners be given back, as well as all the white, half-white babies born of the prisoners and their Indian spouses. So these are Métis or mixed blood babies who have been born to maybe, it looks like Indian fathers, but white mothers who've been adopted, brought up in the tribe. They're totally Indianized. They don't want to go back. And this military leader is trying to get them back, and they just wouldn't go back. And here's a beautiful picture of a woman. This gal was captured at the age of 5 by the Delawares and was raised as a Delaware, knew no English, was found on a reservation about 1819. By some of her Pennsylvania relatives, and she had two daughters by a chief, and they're not very eager to have their picture painted. This one looks very suspicious. The other one totally refuses to have her picture painted, except backwards. So there are hundreds of what I call white Indians living throughout Eastern North America in the colonial period, and they begin in Virginia. I mean, there are white runaways, there are white captives, right from 1607, who go off and live with the Indians voluntarily because it's better than what's being offered in Jamestown. The men are also the religious leaders. This is a shaman with a medicine bag on his pouch, in his medicine amulets and things in his pouch, with raven's wings on his head to symbolize his office. The men are responsible, not only men, the healers of various kinds are responsible for herbal medicine, and women also participate in this, and there are female shamans that we know about. They are responsible for leading religious ceremonies the way a minister would be today. These are effigy poles that have faces carved in them. We don't know, they didn't describe, the Europeans didn't describe this dance with the darn, so we don't exactly know what it is, but since there are green twigs on the people, it might be some kind of green corn, it might be a green corn festival, for instance, celebrating when the corn gets up and going and it's in a green corn state. But the shamans are also responsible for predicting the future as well as curing people. They go into trances and go into contortions, essentially. And they predict whether something's going to happen the next day or not, whether game is going to show up during the hunting season, whether a battle that they're about to undertake is going to be successful. And if they predict that it is not, they don't go. They just simply don't go in their faces. Like ministers, they are also they officiate at the burials. And here's a man dressed. They are fully dressed. They're put in this tightly flexed throne position because you don't have to dig a grave when you do that. And you can be buried at any time of year in a smaller grave. And then you're buried with all the objects that you have possessed during your life, including the scalps that you've taken, for instance. You find scalps in burials, but you're buried with your bows and your arrows and your man and a small pot of food. Why is that? Well, because the heaven is in the southwest, and you need to make a kind of your soul needs to make a kind of long journey, and so you need all you need the souls of all the artifacts that you've lived with to make this journey, and you need some food, obviously, and you need to live there in the village of souls. It's exactly like the village you just left, only it's kind of ethereal, that you've had in your lifetime. And this is what a flexed burial looks like when archaeologists find it. The hands, fingers are often in the mouth, suggesting that this is almost a kind of rebirth, going back to adolescence or infancy, and you're flexed the way you are when you come out of the womb, and you can see all this red ochre earth that may symbolize the blood of birth and death. It's double-edged. Symbolizes rebirth, so you're going to go into another state altogether. And this is the large burial houses. When the Europeans come, they're not only organs back here, they are jewels. These bodies are filled with pearls and with copper, and where any other treasures that the people have accumulated. And sometimes that's of interest. The pearls, especially, are of interest to the Europeans. They become grave robbers and temple breakers, usually in a state of warfare. They don't do it lightly when they first get off the boat. When they're attacking each other, the first place they go to, knowing that it will incent the Indians, is to attack one of these temples and destroy and take the goods from them. Now, the story changes very abruptly in 1607 when the Jamestowners come. You all know the story of the London Company, which is a joint stock capitalist company. It has investors, it has stocks. It has to make a profit, and it doesn't find a source a profitable export for the longest time until they discovered tobacco. What they don't have is supplies. They don't bring enough farmers, they don't bring enough people to do the hard work, they never have enough supplies to feed themselves, and so they instantly get in trouble because they need to get the surplus food, or not even the surplus, the regular food, of the Indians who live nearby, either through trade or through heavy-handed tactics. This is also, you're looking at Paspahegh property here. This is Paspahegh country in the middle of the Powhatan Confederacy, the stupidest place in North America to plant a colony, because this is the most powerful Confederacy in the whole place, and it had, and the state has no exports at this point. It has nothing the company really should want. And so it's floundering around looking for this for the longest time. John Smith, of course, is the only successful administrator they really had, because he understood the Indian people on their own terms to some extent. And he's only there a very short time, and he's not the governor at the very beginning, so there are mistakes made. And there are about three periods just in this first 15 or 20 years. There's a period of from 1607 to 1609 when the colonists and the Indians are sort of feeling each other out. The Indians, on the one hand, don't like the trespassers, but they're few in number, and they keep dying of their own accord, so they're not much of a threat. And they want their trade goods. The trade goods are valuable, and the Europeans bring copper. They bring shiny sheets of copper, which the Indians really love at this point. And they also bring blue glass beads, which have sacred spiritual significance to the Indians because of their color and because of the nature of the glass, which is like crystal, which is also very rare and special to the Indians in their mythology. And then there's a period from 1609 to 14 when you have all-out warfare. That's Powhatan's mantle, by the way. Which is given in 1609 when they try to, the English try to crown Powhatan as a vassal of King James I, and they make him kneel. They push him down on the shoulder. It's a wonderful comic example of the English trying to do things in America. They push him. Powhatan knows what it's about. He's not going to kneel for anybody, right? And so they're pushing him down on his shoulder, trying to get him to just kneel, dip a little bit in obeisance to this the new King James that he's supposed to be a vassal of. And finally they get him down. But they give him a big bed, and they give him a basin and a ewer and a whole bunch of useless furniture, which he promptly puts in his big treasure house at Orfac. And probably doesn't use it again. But they give him a red cloak, which is somewhat unusable. He, in turn, gives Captain Newport this mantle, that's got the beads woven into it, and a pair of little but because of the food the lack of food supply, the Europeans really have to either starve or get tough. When the Indians decide to starve them out and not cooperate, not trade, and then they have to pursue Indian corn supplies, however possible. And they do that with what they call feed fights. They'll take barges and armed men and go up the rivers and come to a village and just commandeer the corn if they will not trade voluntarily. And at certain periods, they're perfectly willing to trade for copper and things, axes, hatchets. But at other times, Powhatan's policy is to resist and not cooperate whatsoever and try to starve them out. And so they go and attack, and that's when things get bad. From 1609 to 1614, you have constant warfare on all sides, and all kinds of atrocities are committed on both sides, and it degenerates. Now, on one of these trips, Captain Smith actually goes up the York River he goes to Powhatan's place first and gets some corn with some strong-arm tactics, and then he comes down the river to Opechancanough's village, the Pamunkey, and he's only got about 30 men who are armed, and they get surrounded very quickly by hundreds of bowmen. But he's kind of a Napoleonic figure anyhow, a tough guy, and he's down all over Eastern Europe fighting Turks and things. So he grabs Opechancanough by the scalp lock and then holds a pistol to his breast and says, let's have a one-on-one combat. You and I, winner take all. And Opechancanough decides the odds are not very good at that point with the gun cocked at his breast. So they load the bars with corn. But Opechancanough never forgets this insult. You don't grab, you never touch an Indian's scalp lock, because that's his soul. You don't do it in fun, and you certainly don't do it in anger. And he harbored that memory and desire for vengeance until 1622. Well, in 1613, of course, the war is brought to a halt because the English kidnap Pocahontas. They find her visiting at a village up near the Potomac. They get her on the boat to look things over with friendly talk and so on, with the help of an Indian couple. And they kidnap her and take her to Jamestown, and she's converted. She's forcibly educated, converts to Christianity voluntarily, and she converts to John Rolfe voluntarily. And they have a baby the next year, and in 1616, they go to England, where she has her fourth companion, and she's the belle of the ball. But one of the neat pictures that we have from a Dutch student's drawing book is one of her attendants who went with her. And this may have been out of Macamoken or whatever his name is. What is it, Helen? Do you remember the name?
Ekantonimo.
You know, the one that's out of
Macamoken? I think Ekantonimo.
Yeah.
That fellow's called Ekantonimo.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
He's wearing traditional garb, this kind of match coat that the old man had. But he's got this very distinctive black and white, almost triangular or checked bag, which we're going to see again in a second. He's wandering around St. James Park, and a Dutch student comes along to paint him, as he's probably eyeing that fat sheep. Now, when tobacco takes off as a craze in Europe, the tobacco plantations finally begin to make some money through the London Company in Virginia, and tobacco is very soil depleting. You have to expand because you don't have fertilizer. You have to expand to keep a big enough crop going to make any money off it. And as the Europeans expanded up the rivers, they put more and more pressure on the Powhatan peoples, and conflict was absolutely inevitable, even in this time of peace from 1614 to 1622. And Opechancanough, Powhatan had died in 1618 from old age, and he just sort of retired from being the paramount chief, gave it to Opechancanough. And Opechancanough, when one of his chief warriors and religious revitalization leaders was killed, Jack of the Feathers, he was known as, in 1622, the Powhatans, as you know, made a concerted uprising and killed 347 colonists in one fell, beautifully coordinated attack all over coastal Virginia. And this is like the European rendition of it. For 10 years, the English pursued the Indians and would not come to the peace table because they wanted to try to exterminate them. They wanted to bring them to their absolute knees and reduce the numbers as fully as possible. They had all kinds of overtures of peace. They could have made peace back in the 20s, early in the 20s. But they kept going until 1632, pursuing and pursuing and pursuing, until they could impose the harshest terms of peace ever. And the Indians were then shut out of the peninsula where we are today. And push north and south. And then in 1644, as you know, Opechancanough, who's extremely old, is being carried around on a litter, can't even hold his own eyes open, he's so old, and he can have his eyes propped open by servants. He makes another concerted attack and kills sort of 500 colonists in another, almost a duplicate of the previous uprising. Well, it only took 2 years to put down this final rebellion in terms of English standards, and to push the Indians on to separate reservations separate territories way out of the way, essentially at West Point where they ended up. And very strict laws. You could not come into English territory unless you wore a striped coat, stopped at a fort along the way, and wore one of these badges that were given to each of the chiefs of the various towns. And you had to carry that badge if you were shot on the site. There's a very complicated history in the 17th century that goes beyond this, and Helen Roundtree ought to be talking about it, but we don't have time to do everything. But this is a picture done about 1709 or 10 or 11 by an immigrant, a Huguenot, I guess, coming over to look for property. And he paints this picture of native Virginians wandering around. Well, they've still got longhead. And remember, the Fort Confederacy has been smashed to smithereens by 1646. It does not exist. So all you have is individual tribal remnants living in various parts of the colony. But the culture doesn't die. The politics might die at this Confederacy level, but the culture persists and well into the 18th century. You've got longhouses still. You've got this very distinctive black and white check way of weaving things, and the other one as well. They're essentially, I don't think he's wearing weaves, that must be a breech clout, but they're still hunting, and they're using a gun now instead of a bow and arrow, perhaps. But they're smoking pipes. Looks like an Aboriginal one, rather than a trade pipe. And they've obviously got their own baskets that they're making. So the culture really doesn't die. And then, as you know, a very harsh peace was imposed on these people. The governor was now the personal trustee and representative of these so-called defeated peoples. And in return for his protection, they had to pay tribute. And so these are the Chickahominies in 1919 coming to the capital and bringing their symbolic tribute, which is turkeys, a deer, probably fish, and so on. Notice the clothing. I mean, the Indians in 1919 are more or less content to, or forced to, they're not forced to, they're content to look like everybody else. They're trying to fit to whatever the stream is at that point, wearing clothes like white people or any kind of people would wear at that time. But by 1980s or so, there are probably some people here to recognize themselves. Is that you, Chief? To a more recent governor, again, making these announcements, I think, coming with the same kind of tribute, symbolizing that they've been defeated in the war. And now the governor, since we don't have a Bureau of Indian Affairs in the state, is their personal trustee and guardian. Any questions? Life, please? How did the Indians fare against diseases? And yeah, there are some diseases, but we don't have archaeological evidence of it. And we don't have a whole lot of written evidence of it. We have some in Roanoke. We know that a lot of people died in Roanoke with the English colony there. But we simply don't have a whole lot of either written or archaeological evidence of pandemics, epidemics in the Virginia situation. And I don't quite know why. There are two explanations. One, it didn't happen in large enough significance to be noticed. Or two, the observers were too busy trying to eat and kill Indians to notice whether they were getting help from microbes. And it was puzzling.
Were the Europeans practicing scalping upon arrival?
No, never.
Never?
No, they didn't scalp in Ireland, they didn't scalp anywhere. The Europeans were taught to scalp by the Indians. And then proceeded to scalp and establish scalp bounties to incur, first of all, to establish, to encourage Indians, friendly Indians, allies, to go scalp Indian enemies. And then gradually to get Europeans to go scalp Indian enemies. And then finally to get Europeans to go scalp European enemies. And so you have a gradual degradation of standards on the European part. The scalp bounty is nothing but a way of getting proof that your warriors have killed the people they said they killed. I mean, if you're going to hire warriors, which is what you're doing, mercenaries, you have to have some proof that they're doing their job. They're not on salary like a modern soldier. So if you're going to pay them money for a scalp, I mean, for killing somebody, you better have some proof, and so they bring back the scalp.
How long before European scalp and the numbers exceed that of Native Americans?
Well, there's no way of knowing that.
I mean, wild guess.
Well, I don't think they ever exceed Indian scalp. They're just too... First of all, it's dangerous work. Very dangerous work. And there's no need. See, the European soldiers tend to be more or less on salary, whereas the Indian allies are not. And so it's only freelancers who like the scalp bounties. And every time you have a tough Indian war, they encourage scalp bounties. The legislatures passed it and put up big money, but that didn't do any good because the whole object was to be an offensive against the Indian offensive. Instead of waiting back in your little forts being attacked, this is to encourage, scalp bounties were to encourage European soldiers to go out and hit first. And not too many European soldiers were able to do that. They just weren't trained at it, they weren't good at it. And so they didn't collect the bounties, frankly. There were never very many European scalp takers.
One of the theories that I had heard is that the first one they would send them out, they would hire like the Indians to go tell all the Indian people, and what they would do is they would bring back years. And they would bring back 2 years. And then they figured if they could only bring back one scalp. But it was not necessarily the Indians' idea to do the scalping. It was their way of being reimbursed for killing somebody.
Well, Indians, if they had their own brothers, would often bring back a head. But you can't do that when you're very far away. It's a fairly close battle, you might bring back the whole head. And Europeans took heads. They preferred heads in Ireland and elsewhere. I want to get to this question because it's very frequently raised. There's nothing barbarian or savage about scalping. It's a lot more humane than taking a whole head. You can survive scalping. And it's tied up with religious things, remember. That scalp lock has religious significance to these people. What you're doing is destroying the personhood of that person by taking his scalp. And if he survives, well, you know, that's okay too. The Europeans and Indians in general will take heads whenever possible because you have the identity of the victim as well, which if you want to line your path to your tent, for instance, and bring in enemy, you know, captives, you can prove to them that you've got Uncle Jim and Aunt Seth and, you know, all this stuff. It's an identity. There's nothing... I just don't think any of you should be too upset about having scalp before somebody else. It's like taking ears or fingers in Vietnam. It's just a way of proving you've done what you said you did. And all cultures have to do that in warfare some way or another. You know, World War II, we took German belt buckles and helmets and stuff like that. So I don't think it's an issue anybody should be concerned about.
We are limited on...